You're listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners. To donate, click on the Canada Helps button or go to westhill.net/donate.
Ken Ramsey, who is a member of the congregation, is going to lead us by asking us some questions in order that we can draw as broad a swath in this conversation as possible. However, there may be things that you particularly would like to ask, and so when we're finished these sort of questions that we hope will get much of it out, that you will have an opportunity to ask some questions as well. So in order to speed that along, we'll get going. The purpose of today is really to build some comfort with the term atheism within the congregation, with the use of that term to describe your minister, me, and to help us move into that space that we have intentionally been creating, that space that goes beyond the beliefs that divide, that calls us into a new kind of being church in community and being in community itself. So, Ken.
Great, thank you. Oh, I've got the good microphone. So here's some questions that will prompt an explanation of what we're looking at today. I'm going to start with you, Catherine. Your organization represents clergy who no longer believe. Do all these people call themselves atheists?
That's a very good question. Before I answer that, I just want to give a little bit of background information to everyone here about the Clergy Project. We are a group of about 450 active, like Greta, and former clergy persons who are non-believers. So to answer your question, not all of our members identify as atheist. Many identify as secular humanist. Some identify as agnostic or free thinkers. The commonality between all our members is that we have packed away supernaturalism and we embrace the reality of life and all that it has to offer us.
Good. So there's a spectrum, I think you're saying.
Yeah.
Why would some choose not to call them atheists if that term describes them?
Well, I think the word atheist is the issue. I mean, the word atheist isn't much of a describer as far as it comes to, when it comes to values or when it comes to, I guess, appreciation for life. It's very kind of cut and dry. The word atheist just means that you do not believe in a deity. That is the basic understanding of it. So the no theistic beliefs or no beliefs in supernaturalisms. So it's not a very good, a succinct word when it comes to the plethora of creativity and enjoyment and wonder that people experience in life. So I think it has its limits. It is it's a hard and fast reality. You know, our members do not believe in a God, but it doesn't define their entire character or, you know, their appreciation at being alive. So.
So it's like most labels, it's limited,
it's very
you're
limited.
Saying.
Yeah.
So is there, tell me about the differences in atheism itself.
Well,
and Greta can chime in too.
Actually, why don't you?
Yeah, sure. As Catherine said, the word atheism, it's a word that's created. Theism, theo is the word God. Theism is a belief in a God. Atheism means not God or no God. So it means that you don't believe in a God. But there are people who don't believe in God because they say there's proof that there is no God, and those are called strong atheists. And then there are those who say, I don't think that you can prove that there's a God. I don't see any proof for a God, so therefore I don't believe in a God. And that would be called a weak atheism, a positive atheism. So those terms are not interchangeable, but the word atheism is the same word to describe both of them. So it's difficult because I would consider myself, I would say there, you know, I don't see any proof for God, so therefore I don't believe there is a God. I wouldn't say there is proof that there is no God. So my perspective is somewhat different than some. So there are variations within even the term atheist.
Okay.
I would agree with Greta in that there is no proof for a deity of any sort. But I think the individuals who are looking to have their values reflected and don't see them in atheism, they're still there if you look at skeptical inquiry in some instances, but also in science. Richard Dawkins was just in town promoting his new film, The Unbelievers, and he spent quite a lot of time talking about the beauty that is reality, and that the truth is beautiful, and that the things that we can know are beautiful and enlightening and informative, and they bring meaning into our lives.
Nevertheless, the label does exist, mm-hmm. and Greta, you've been labeled many times, and you've even used the language on radio and to express yourself at times. And so could you, what does it feel like to have that label put on you?
Often when that label is put on me, it's put on me without any kind of conversation about what my beliefs are, and as Catherine has said, what my values are, what things are important to me. Most frequently it's put on me by evangelical Christians who want to completely discredit anything I have to say to the community. And so they're using it as a huge label in order to dismiss me, or in order to raise anger and hostility toward me. And that's one of the reasons why I think it's so important that I claim the label rather than just allow others to give it to me, because it's such a tiny wedge of who I am, and it doesn't describe me completely at all. It describes me. I don't believe in a God, but all of the characteristics that make up who I am and that I bring to the contribution of my leadership in this work cannot be put away under that banner and then dismissed. We want people to realize that the word is one that has a lot more nuances, that the people who take that label have a lot of good and a lot of value to bring to a world that is constantly struggling with these kinds of terms.
So why label yourself at all? Why not just talk about yourself and the values? Why even take on the label?
Some of the reasons that I want to take on the label is I want to take the power of it away from those who are trying to use it in a negative way. And so I want to take that power away from them, and I also want to align myself with those who use the term and who are about seeking truth, about exploring the world, about engaging in dialogue and conversation that will pull us beyond those beliefs that divide us. Belief systems are held around the world in a variety of different things and different ways. They're not all negative. But the conversation that's being brought to the table by those who would consider themselves atheists and critical thinkers and secular humanists, those conversations can draw us further into a deep and meaningful conversation. So mostly it's that I want to take power away from that and also highlight the ways in which the term is used and the way that it raises safety issues for people who are labeled as atheists in countries and in places where that is not tolerated, and to move beyond that, those beliefs that cause that kind of harm.
Okay. So we have to dig a little deeper into this, I think.
Right? Absolutely.
So if one is an atheist, does it mean that there's no belief in lots of other mysterious things? I call it mystery, right? Things like the supernatural, homeopathy, New Age, we'll call it, and the ability to converse with people after they die, which is a fairly widely held belief. Does that mean an atheist gets rid of all of that?
The short answer to that question is yes. To be an atheist, in a sense, or a byproduct of atheism, is skeptical inquiry, and to scrutinize the evidence for, say, crystals or homeopathy or faith healing, to look at what the facts are, and to know that even if there aren't these mysteries, you know, that some people like to cling to, that these things don't really exist, there are plenty of things that are in our world and our universe to inspire us or to give us pause or to profoundly impact us. The thing that we need to be cognizant of is our role in creating that meaning and creating those values and maintaining and sustaining them. So yes, and I think it's a good thing to be skeptical of things that promise you an easy answer or an easy out. The reality is that it took millions of years for human beings to become human beings. It was not an instantaneous event. And I think that it limits our ability to participate fully in our own lives and to impact the lives of others when we accept those types of events as having happened or being real.
The short answer to that question is no.
Like most questions, it's not that short.
But I'm gonna. But this allows me to get into the realm of agnostic, being agnostic. Gnosis is knowledge. Agnostic means I don't have that knowledge. So in the realm of the nature of reality, I would claim myself to be an agnostic. So those things that I don't know about, one of the phrases that has become really, really important is that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. So if something has not been explored, if we haven't actually tested it, and so we don't know where it's coming from or how it happens, I'm going to be fairly agnostic about it. If we've done research and we know it doesn't work, then I'm going to say, it doesn't work. You've got to prove to me that it works, right? So I think that there's a lot more room there than Catherine is perhaps willing to give it. But I also think that when it comes right down to it, and in this I'm on exactly the same page as Catherine. If we were able to figure it out, if those things that even now we can't replicate with experiments or we can't prove, and people keep looking at them, trying to figure them out, that if we do, if we find that there is something that's happening there, we're going to find that it's something that's operating in the natural realm. It's not something that's happening because there's another realm beyond us that is bringing it into being. So we have no idea, and that was what the focus moment was about. We have no idea even what is between you and I right now. If we could see everything that's between you and I, we wouldn't be able to see each other. We don't know how our minds work, and a lot of it is neurological. We don't know the extent of all of that. So I'm agnostic around a lot of those things. But I do believe that in the end, whatever is functioning in our world will abide by natural principles, the understanding of which is constantly evolving. You know, our quantum theory that we spoke about a few weeks ago had no idea anything about that, you know, back in 100 years ago. So we're learning so much stuff all the time. So.
Okay, and just another question. What do you say to someone who has experienced something? And so they have their own personal experience.
Absolutely. And if someone has experience, I can't say that someone has no experience of something. It's their experience. If I had that same experience, would I interpret it the same way? Maybe not. So there's a difference between experience and interpretation. And I have to honor someone's choice to interpret something in a certain way and their experience, but I do not need to accept their interpretation of it if I am having that same experience. So an experience that I've had is that sort of a shift in reality. I've always assumed it was just something that everyone had. I only found out years later that other people had that. I now think it's probably associated with my migraines. But there are those who would say that I'm a mystic because of that shift in my perception, which happens for a short period of time, very rarely. I would not say that I'm a mystic, which means that there's some kind of supernatural thing happening to me, that God is trying to speak to me in some way. That's an interpretation which I don't need to accept, but someone else might make it. So someone's experience, if their experience is very real to them, and they get to interpret it in whatever way they choose. If they're interpreting it in a way that is going to cause harm to others, then we get to actually restrain them from doing that. I mean, so, and there are situations where that might be the case. Did you want to add?
Mm-hmm. I would say I agree with you, Greta. individuals will have their own interpretation, as Greta had said, but whether or not it's reproducible, measurable, someone might think that they're conversing with angels, and what is actually happening is they're having a seizure. There needs to be investigation as to what exactly is going on, and it's not necessarily there's no scheme on the part of atheists to try to quell individual expression or experience or interpretation. But there is a searching by atheists and skeptics and humanists to understand, well, what is actually happening? What is the what event is occurring? Because by better understanding it, we can make better decisions and better judgments.
One of the very interesting things that Richard Dawkins said this week was that scientists are not, or maybe it was Lawrence Krauss, anyway, that scientists are not out to prove things wrong. They are out to prove things right. And so when a claim is made, they will do everything in their power to prove that it's right. And it's only when they're unable to do that that they'll start looking for something else that's right, that they can, that will then explain that phenomenon and help us understand it, and then perhaps utilize it to make the world a better place.
Okay, let's shift gears a little bit here. The term atheist itself, the word, creates reaction, and usually that reaction, certainly in our society, is one of hostility or animosity. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think there's probably two major reasons, and one is that to be an atheist is to be an apostate, and we have a history of Christianity in our culture religion being a dominant force. So if you're an apostate, then you're counter to the norm. So I think that is just part of the fabric of our culture that we may or may not be aware of. So that's one thing. But then there's also been consistent lobbying on the behalf of religious organizations, and in particular political organizations such as the McCarthy era, against the word atheist and linking it to communism and creating it as the other. You're outside of the group, you're, annexed, and because of that, you're different, and you're a challenge to us. So I think that is really at the root of where the hostility and animosity towards atheism comes from. The other issue that I will say is that I think when people don't like having their beliefs confronted, and atheists and skeptics and free thinkers like to question beliefs. That's part of what makes us excited about living, is having the opportunity and ability to do that. So when you confront someone who doesn't want to have their beliefs questioned, then you will encounter that animosity as well.
I think Catherine is right. It has been linked to other movements that are more related to power, the abuse of power and violence, and it's easy to link a label with that and then denigrate the entire thing. So, I mean, I know that there are people who are concerned that we're embracing that term and concerned that our property will be damaged or harm will come to me or someone in the congregation as a result of that. And I think it's because of that pairing of the term with all that is horrible in society, instead of labeling and identifying carefully that those things are connected to violence and to across everything. I mean, there are Christians who use their faith in order to be violent, and there are atheists who will do that, and there are people from every faith tradition who will use their beliefs to express violence or to claim a power and authority where they do not have it. And so I think we need to recognize that those elements are the part things that we need to be careful of, and not the label. I think it's just been a very good, there's been a very effective campaign to denigrate the label atheist.
What you didn't mention, either of you, was the stake of organized religion. And it seems to me that there's a lot riding on keeping atheism as the other, mm-hmm. so to speak. Mm-hmm. And we're aware of the, you know, the spectrum of organized religion, how powerful that is.
Mm-hmm. And the rise of the that group of people who in census data identify as not being connected with any religion. They're called the nuns, N-O-N-E-S. And the rise of the nuns is we're seeing that across the Western world very, very rapidly. And that goes to the ongoing health and presence of religious community. And so the word atheist continues to have to be the other, even though we are and have been for many years on that line, if not beyond it. We have, and so this is saying we are not the other. We're all the same.
However, and you make the point that it's growing. So the nuns are growing. Why is this? Why now?
I think that probably the predominant reason would be because of science, because of an increase of education, because of technology like the internet, an increase in access to information and sharing of information. That's contributed greatly to the rise of this new atheism that seems to be exploding everywhere. You know, when it comes to the world prior to the real rise of atheism, people kind of maintained the status quo. There was a time when people went to church for answers, and some people still come to church for answers, but not in the same sense that they used to. If you want to ask, how far away is the sun, or the church doesn't respond to those inquiries anymore. We get those responses from scientists. The scientists tell us how old our planet is. The scientists tell us the size of our universe, or what is in our DNA, or how we are all related, or how we are all connected on that level. So there's really no other path. As science informs our understanding, church in the traditional sense is being deconstructed. But I would say that there's a great opportunity for congregations like West Hill to leave a place for people that are interested in science and how the world really is, the nature of reality, but still want community. And I think that's really important, that be articulated, that church may have a place, but it will morph into something that looks more like West Hill than your traditional Catholic church, per se.
And I also, and Catherine sort of touched on this, but I think that it's just becoming more acceptable, so more and more people will identify because they recognize that others are willing to identify as well. So I think that it will, a critical mass will watch those numbers go up very, very quickly over the next decade or so.
Maybe, just maybe, there's always been a certain percentage of the population who are atheists, only now they can talk about it a little more.
Yeah.
They have a platform, it's on TV, our book study several years ago, studied two books on it. So it gets talked about, and so maybe people are just being honest.
Yeah.
And feel more safe in doing that. However, not everyone's safe, right? And we hear stories about people in other countries, other societies, for whom it's not safe. And I think maybe that adds to the visibility. Could you comment on that?
Some of you may have seen in the news recently about some protesters in Bangladesh who were arrested and accused of being atheists. They are denying that they are atheists, but the term has been applied to them. The label is on them. And so they are now at risk. There's calls for their execution because they are atheists and because they do not ascribe to the religion of the country. And so that's a huge concern, and there's been a worldwide reaction to that. Fazid Say, who is a world-renowned pianist in Turkey, was caught tweeting some anti-religious statements that were against the religious beliefs of in Turkey. And so he was tried and found guilty of doing that and is now serving 10 months in prison for that. So there are people who are very visibly dangerous, but not just in those countries that are run by theocracies, but the rights of people who do not want to have to ascribe to religious beliefs or who want to participate in ways that are not outlined and specified by religious beliefs, their rights are being challenged as well. And even here in Canada, we've watched the Office of Religious Freedom open up, which is a position, an organizing or a part of the government that is now headed by an evangelical Christian who's the principal of a very small evangelical college housed in a congregation that makes statements about atheists and fundamentalist secularism and as something that is inherently wrong. And so for someone in an office of religious freedom to state that those who are not religious as being fundamentally wrong is an issue for Canadians, I believe. And so, and we don't know how that will play itself out. So we need to be open about that because we don't know how rights are going to be involved. And funding. We've talked about funding here at West Hill as well, that funding for international work being done by evangelical organizations, government funding, has risen by 45% over the last 3 years, whereas funding for those organizations, religious or otherwise, that are doing work that is about building democracy and strengthening individual and democratic rights in countries, that funding has been pulled back. So how is that related to the belief structures that are informing our government? And Marcy MacDonald, who's written a book on this, says that we need to be afraid, be very afraid. And she certainly writes that in her book.
I'd like to reiterate everything that Greta has said. There is a It is really troubling to think that individuals around the world are being persecuted because of a lack of belief in a prescribed deity. But I think if I look at some of the members of the Clergy Project, and we have members all over the world, we actually have a member in Turkey, India, Egypt, so we have members that are in countries where there is religious persecution, and also the United States, there's religious persecution for atheists. So coming out and being open about your lack of a belief in a deity can have consequences here as well. I think particularly one of our members who's out, his name is Jerry DeWitt, and he lost his job and nearly lost his house and his marriage because he changed his belief and is now describes himself as a humanist, an atheist and a humanist. So it is really troubling to think that an idea, a concept, has more weight and more importance in a culture or a society than the life and free expression of an individual. And Greta's very right that we should be troubled. We should be asking our politicians why this is so, because you know, human rights should be the pinnacle that we aspire to, not maintaining the status quo.
So let me ask about the clergy project. What precisely does it do? What kind of work do you do? And then after, maybe Greta could explain your involvement in it.
Okay. Well, we've only been around for about 2 years now. We just celebrated our anniversary in March, which was really exciting. We were founded originally by a core group of about 50 members who are non-believing active and former clergy persons. And we were founded and funded by a group of friendly individuals and organizations. Predominantly, our primary funder is the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Science and Reason. So he's one of our founders, as is the executive director, Elizabeth Robin Cornwell, and then Dan Barker from the Freedom from Religion Foundation out of Wisconsin, Daniel Dennett, the philosopher, and researcher Linda Lascola. So these leaders in the atheist movement recognized that there was a number of non-believing active and former clergy persons that were out there. They had no idea how many were there. They just knew that they existed. And they wanted to create a sanctuary. And that's what the Clergy Project is. It's an online safe house for active and former clergy persons to sit, to talk, to reach out, to find peers and community so that they know they're not alone, because it's an incredibly alienating experience to one day kind of awaken to the fact that what you thought you believed, you don't, and you now have evidence for not believing in it. There's a lot of entanglement with family, with communities, with friends, and so the Clergy Project provides that place for our members to talk about those challenges and those difficulties. We've just recently, since October 2012, have come out publicly that we exist, we are here, and we have been accepting new applicants. We've grown from 52 to 442 as of Friday, and we're constantly doing intake. So we have a rolling intake. We're working on program development because, as you can appreciate, I'm sure, trying to transition out of ministry is not easy. Aside from the family issues, there's financial issues and sustainability issues. So we were recently given a donation from Todd Stiefel and the Stiefel Freethought Foundation of $100,000 to do outplacement services for our members. So to assess their skills, to help them with resumes and preparation so that they can go and find jobs outside of ministry. Another project we've been working on is with the American Humanist Association, and they've created a quick access route so our members can become humanist celebrants and officiants. And one of the places that we see our members maybe going to, and we see this with Greta and with other members of the Clergy Project, is leading humanist congregations. And this is something that's growing. This is something that's popping up all over the place, all around the world. People are talking about humanist, non-believing persons coming together in community. And we would like, many of our members are interested in seeing where that goes and becoming leaders in that. So that's just a little bit of what we've been doing. We've been quite busy. So I'll let Greta talk a little bit about it.
Yeah.
My involvement, and I don't even really, can't remember how I came to know about the Clergy Project. I'm not really sure. I think it was Linda Lascola who told me about it. And so I've been a member for, I don't know, about a year, I think, and have acted as a screener, which means that the applications that come in are divided up, and I primarily do applications from Canada. But I have access to, and we all have access to, reading the stories of all these people who apply. And there were 442 on Friday. There were at least two more applications on Saturday. And the stories are, as Catherine has said, they're stories of that have incredible complexity in them, people whose lives are so interwoven into their work, as ministry is, who cannot disentangle easily, who can't see themselves putting what they do on a resume and being respected in the secular world for it, despite the fact that Jerry, having moved into a job in the secular world, lost that job when he disclosed that he was an atheist there. So the challenge, there's a very big challenge there, but the key element is loss and grief. Those are huge. And so being able to process that and create a community that helps people support one another as they go through that is incredible. So I'm honored to be part of it.
You're a screener. What do you screen?
I screen the applications.
Okay.
So when someone sends an application in, we screen them to make sure that they fit the criteria, which is about supernatural belief, essentially. Because the forum is highly confidential. If some of these people were outed in their community, it would be extremely hard on them and traumatic and tragic for all of them.
Okay. Let's talk about this community, right? Several years ago, it was progressive over time, but certainly marked by your first book, you started to have us question the reality of a supernatural God or person or deity. And this congregation started to change, and people left. Can you describe, from your point of view, what was going on?
When we began this process in about 2001, September 2001, I believe, is when the board and I had a conversation about whether or not I could continue, having preached a sermon which totally left God in little chunks lying around on the ground. There wasn't very much left when I finished that sermon. And so I recognized that I was not doing what the congregation had called me to do. And so that led to a conversation with the board. And the board at that time, as in an extraordinary act of, courage, said, okay, well, let's find out where this is taking us. And so we headed out on that journey. And over the course of the next 5 years, really looked at ourselves, wrote vision works, sort of put the stakes in the ground. Okay, we're here. We made it here. Okay, we made it here. We made it here. And identified where we were. And many of those people, there was a lot of really positive energy. It was intense. People were passionate about it. One guy used to come into church, even before we started this process, with a book under his arm that identified which parts of the gospel stories Jesus actually said. And then if I preached on something that Jesus said, he'd come up afterwards and say, you know, Jesus didn't say that. It says right here in the book, Jesus didn't say that. So people were very excited about this journey, and they'd been reading books in this area for 20 years at that point in time. So when we made a number of significant changes, and my book was published in 2008, a lot of those people who had been on the journey with us, who intellectually were there before we even got there as a community, chose to leave the congregation. And that was the heartbreak for me and for many people in this congregation. It was a horribly difficult time. It's easy to say, oh, they left because Greta doesn't believe in God anymore. But most of them don't believe in the kind of God. I mean, most of them, if we sat down with an actual dictionary and defined, they'd come out as atheists as well. But that does not believe that they don't find comfort in extrinsic forms of religion that were here that are no longer. So that is the use of scripture on a weekly basis, the focus of the community's gatherings to learn about that scripture and to talk about that as the document that calls us to live in right relationship with one another. And we now find in a variety of sources that challenge to live in right relationship with one another. So the loss of that book, the loss of the Bible, was a huge element. The loss of what we called the disciples' prayer was a huge element. The loss of some of the songs was huge. The loss of the organ was big. So there were things that had to do with, and we didn't take the organ out because I'm an atheist. We took the organ out because it broke. Just so you know.
True. I remember.
I just thought that could be misunderstood. And I think the things that may, like I think about what we do here, you know, when I say set aside those things that you're busy about, you know, that are on your mind, and find this space where you can be fully attentive here. For some people, getting into that space requires certain things. It requires certain language. It requires certain symbols. It requires things that they have known all their lives. And without those things, they can't get into that space. So many of them, most of them, I think, are now in a space where they get those things, and they can get. And that's the work about living in right relationship with self, others, and the planet is the important work. So let's find ways to get into that space where you can do that work. And if it has to be a place that has different religiosity, that it was heartbreaking, but that's a good thing that they are now someplace where they do that.
I know a lot of people here, and I think in this assembly we have a wide spectrum of belief and in various points on that spectrum, but in labeling you as an atheist, and you say that, is there danger of labeling this group of people as well?
I seriously hope not, but I'm pragmatic enough to know that there will be people who label this place as an atheist church. And I even actually slipped and said that on the radio one time. I generally try very hard to say, if I'm talking about this church and atheists, I say this is a church where atheists are comfortable, or this is a church for atheists. It's not, but there are people in this congregation who are very traditional believers, people who are religious humanists, people who are secular humanists, people who would consider themselves free thinkers, people who would call themselves atheists or agnostics, people who say, don't label me anything, I don't want a label. And what we've worked here to create is what I call a non-exclusive community. So if you are from another faith tradition, or you are an atheist, or you are a traditional Christian believer, if what you're trying to do is live in right relationship with yourself, with others, and the planet, this place will not use language or anything that prevents you from being on that journey here. That's not to say that we have all the elements that you might need, and so you may find another setting, a more comfortable place, but we won't use language or things that would exclude you. And so my hope is that we will continue to create and pull a very diverse community together.
So with or without God still stands.
Absolutely, yes. Right. Yes, with or without God.
Catherine, how do you see your project in relationship to someone like Greta, who is leading this congregation in this very, very difficult way, and challenging? It's challenging. You have to do lots of explanation, lots of clarification. That, how does your project relate to that?
Well, Greta is a member of the Clergy mm-hmm. Project, as she said, and I think that Greta is an example of what can happen when you have someone who is as committed to her values as Greta is, but is able to throw her arms wide and welcome different perspectives. So I think she's very much a leader in that respect, and there are members of the Clergy Project that would like to emulate what Greta has here in this congregation with all of you, because they see the value in the relationships that are built and how you love and support one another, and the potential that you have to be leaders in what really is a new way of thinking about community and church. So yes, there is a large number of individuals in the Clergy Project that really are looking as an example. Actually, Linda LaScola is doing a little bit of research around what's going on here at West Hill, and also with a group called the Houston Oasis out of Texas, and then a group in London, England called the Sunday Assembly. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of resurgence on this communal or congregational model. The potential that it has to bring together, as Greta was saying, persons with different perspectives. I think it's phenomenal that you have a spectrum of individuals in this congregation, some that have more traditional beliefs and others that, you know, would identify as atheists. It's something that you should be congratulated on, that you're so welcoming and have taken this really courageous step to stand up and say, no, these are what our values are. This is how we identify, and this is who we are.
Good. Do you want to throw it open?
Yeah.
At this
absolutely.
Thing? Is there any other questions
we
out
have
there?
Microphones on either side. If anyone has a question that they'd like to throw at us. Okay, we have to keep. Yes, okay, Anna Marie has a question. If you could, I just want to tell you before you start asking a question, if you're concerned, we are recording this and it will be posted, probably on a variety of sites. If you don't want to be on those sites, just let Dana know and she'll take you out following the service. So it doesn't mean you can't ask a question, you can just be removed from the video.
Take you out.
Go nuts. Like, just ask whatever you want to ask. We can take it all out later.
Well, I really believe in what you're doing here, Greta, but when I try to defend it to my friends, I need more words. I need more ammunition. What I'm always asked is, how does this church stay within the fold of the United Church? And I don't know how to answer it.
Well, that's an excellent question. it's a very good question. I really want to, I do want to deal with that. One of the things about, it's hard to describe this church. We have some people here who have been coming in the last few weeks, who have been introduced to West Hill by Wayne Crosley. When Wayne died and people gathered in this community to mourn his loss, they realized that this is a very different place than their stereotypical understandings of it, or their understandings of it that have been informed by stereotype. So they've now found this a comfortable place to be, and so they're here. So it's very hard to describe what we're doing. But yes, why does the United Church continue to stretch its arms wide enough to include us up until now? I think it's because the United Church, I haven't gone off the rails in terms of what the United Church teaches. And that's a very important thing for us to remember. When I went to theological college, I was taught that the Bible was a construction made by human people who were trying to explain the world using a worldview that was contemporary to them. And in their explanations, they wrote down things that helped make sense to them. And those stories we have elevated to a divine authorship. And that is not where the stories came from. So at theological college, I'm taught that they're humanly constructed stories. So if something is a humanly constructed story, you get to critique the whole thing. And especially when others attribute divine authority to a document, we have the responsibility to critique it and be very, very clear about it. So I was taught that at the bosom of the United Church of Canada. And so they are uncomfortable, I would think, not prepared to attack what I'm doing and what we are doing as a community. That does not mean that certain colleagues who have a very a much stronger, more conservative understanding of Christianity would not try to hold a hearing into my beliefs and have me removed from the roles of the United Church of Canada. And that may happen at some point in the future.
And we'll have to cope with that. We'll have to have a conversation about how to deal with that when that happens. But I think that the reality is the United Church has been bold on many fronts in its history. When it came together, it was bold about the realities of poverty and the disparity between the rich and the poor. Over the course of its history, it's been bold about the leadership that women have to offer in the church. It's been bold about the dissolution of marriage and the reality that beyond divorce, those who have led can continue to lead. It's been bold about abortion. It's been bold about relationship. It's been bold about gender. It's been bold about empire. It's been bold about so many things, and we're just asking it to be bold about this too. And my hope is that it will continue to be brave. Thank you, Ingrid.
Questions along the same lines, but I want to take it one step further. We're saying, well, as long as the United Church tolerates us and we are behaving, we can stay. But is there no benefit to joining a humanistic organization or a Unitarian church? We're always worried that financially we're cannot stay viable if we don't get more members, because it's of the size of the building and the size of the personnel and things.
We have had some of those conversations in the past, particularly when we did see such a dramatic loss of members, and so a subsequent loss of financial support. We have had those conversations beyond the United Church of Canada. I'm not, and that may happen. I couldn't preclude that possibility that we might end up in a situation like that and make a decision like that. Right now, I think that where we are within a Christian, identified Christian denomination is where I would prefer we remain, because I am convinced, and this is probably obvious, but I am convinced that we are middle of the road, 21st century evolution of the thought that started way back when, at the beginning of this movement. I'm convinced that we, had we not aligned ourselves with the powers that be, not been afraid to open ourselves to scientific inquiry and the new understandings that science brought to the world, had we not been afraid of those things, we would have evolved to where our thought has evolved long, long ago. And so I consider us in the middle of the road of the evolution of that iteration of faith called Christianity. And so I think that it is, because we have done it within a Christian denomination, I think that it is our responsibility to call that denomination to this perspective over and again. And if possible, and I will align myself with Margaret Thatcher, who said there would never be a prime minister, a female prime minister in Britain in her lifetime. So I will say, not in my lifetime, will the United Church of Canada actually come out and publicly say that the Bible is not the authoritative word of God for all time. But I think Margaret was kind of hoping, you know, it might be so when she was asked that question, and I'm hoping it might be so. That the United Church, if any denomination is going to do it, it's the United Church of Canada. And it's Christianity that needs to be critiqued, and not necessarily a humanist organization or the Unitarian Universalist. Did you want to say anything?
I just wanted to say that I completely agree with what Greta has said, that you have an opportunity to take a leadership role, that Christianity is morphing into something different, and that in a way, a congregation like this would be more attractive to the nuns, as Greta said previously, than a traditional sense. I mean, there's a traditional church. There's a reason why Christianity and church attendance is declining. And it's because they're not engaged, and because there's still that throwback to the Bible as the authority in the congregation. And both Greta and I know, having gone through our master's programs, that we are told, every minister that goes through an MDiv is told that the Bible is not as you had previously thought so. So the reality is that every priest, every every minister, every pastor who's gone through biblical scholarship knows what that is a resource. It's a human tool that was used, and we have so many other tools that are at our disposal now. So I'll shut up so someone else can ask a question.
For being here, I escaped from a fundamentalist church. It felt like an escape to me, my late teens, early 20s, and spent the rest of my life in sort of a searching mode, I guess, and looked everywhere. But now I feel as though I've come to a community where I can explore and ask questions, and the answers are not necessarily there, but the space and the openness is there to ask the questions. And I feel as though at this time I'm finally coming home, and it's nice to feel that I'm coming home to someplace where I can do all those things that you're talking about. Thank you so much.
A couple more questions.
Okay, so when you say you're looking for a middle-of-the-road approach in the traditions of Christianity, one of the things that I grapple with is the Bible. I don't know, you know, I've been sort of church for many years, and I've never really considered it a divine Word of God, and I don't remember ever being told that it was, but I know that was the official belief. But there's a lot of wisdom there, and I guess my question is, and also in terms of along the lines of tradition, being in the Christian tradition, where's the balance? If you want to go middle of the road, you kind of need a balance.
Yeah, I'm not wanting to be middle of the road in what the Christian tradition currently would identify as the middle of the road. What I'm saying is that if we had evolved over the course of the last 18 centuries, we would be in the middle of the road, right? We are now considered to be way off on this post-theistic fringe, but Christianity would have probably become post-theistic maybe around the 13th century or earlier. We would have become post-theistic, or maybe even before that. We would certainly have been post-theistic a couple of hundred years ago. And so us being a post-theistic congregation that welcomes all puts us in a certain position vis-a-vis the rest of Christianity at this point in time. But I'm saying if we had evolved, we wouldn't be, you know, considered extraordinary. In terms of the texts of the church, the Bible, I think that the wisdom that can be distilled from the Bible and scripture passages, we read scripture passage last week, it was the reading. We are open to bringing into this place for your edification anything that is worthy of being brought into this place. But if it is not worthy of being brought into this place, if it will not lift up your perspective, your passion, your desire to live in right relationship, then it should not be brought in this place. So there is much within that text which would not meet that requirement. And so it isn't searched on a weekly basis for something that will do that work, because we have brought it down from its exalted position, and now it's one of, you know, how many pages are written a day, are published on the net a day, like from all of the gifts. So Bertrand Russell's reading that Catherine shared today, that was a piece that we could engage. So it isn't privileged. That's the thing. It's no longer privileged in the way it was before. So one more question?
I don't see any more. Oh, one more. Jim will have to bring it up.
I'm just curious, actually, as you say that
in school, in theory, you're taught that it is man-made or, you know, written. Are you then told to lie about it? Like, why is that not what comes out then?
Well, we're told that it's allegory. We're taught that there's insights that can be pulled from the scripture. We're told that this is our historical context. We're told that this is our resource, right? This is our manual, so to speak. But we're also taught that it was written in a very convoluted way and patched together, and there are forgeries in it, and it was coalesced into one book by a council. It did not come down from on high as the book that we know today. So yes, we're not told to lie. Well, we're told, because we're not told that it's a lie. We're told that it's our resource, and that's what we use. That is part of our tradition. So, yeah, I think that.
Yeah, it's not that we're told to lie. It's that we learn enough about it that we can use the language and mean something very different. So I can talk about God creating love, God giving you energy, God bringing you the strength that you need, God being present to you in a time of trouble. And my definition of God, which is that which exists between you and I, and we get to make that sacred or we get to destroy it. And if we make it sacred, we're creating God in the world. So when I say God will bring you courage, that makes perfect sense with my definition of God. But you may think that I'm talking about a divine being outside in a supernatural realm who is going to, you know, create a shaft of courage to you because I've said that and I'm a God bearer in some way. So we just learn to use language and have metaphorical understandings or allegorical explanations for it, and to understand the stories as myth or as contextually created. And we just don't share that with you. And that's why the work that I've been involved in is mostly challenging about language, because if my colleagues are utterly comfortable using the phrase, and a conversation I had with one, the phrase, Jesus is Lord. And when I pushed someone and said, what do you mean by that? I said, you know what I mean by that? Jesus against Caesar. Jesus against the corporate culture. It's a metaphor. Mm-hmm. But if I were to stand up here and say Jesus is Lord, I would be willing to bet if we took a vote, none of you would have got that out of that's what I was saying. So he's got it in his head that it does not mean Jesus is a supernatural being who has authority and hasn't been given, you know, that particular authority because he's a divine son of God. They've got that in their head, but they're still using a phrase because they've created an understanding of it that they can align their heart with. That understanding is not shared with the communities to which they speak. So other understandings, for good or for ill, can remain held within those communities.
Why not?
Why not what?
Why
isn't it shared?
Right.
Oh, yeah, you can answer that.
I would say the reason that it's not shared is because it is troubling for people's faith. And people do not like to be challenged, as I said earlier, about why some people are, there's animosity towards atheism, is because they don't like to have their ideals or their beliefs around something challenged. And I will tell you, having sat through biblical scholarship courses, people have gotten up and walked out because they have not liked the truth that the professor was telling them about the origins of Genesis, right? So this is the reality. We cannot change the fact, you know, that there are two creation myths in Genesis, that they were written by two different groups in two different locations, that it was impacted by the Babylonian exile. We can't change those facts. But many ministers and priests and rabbis They take a very paternalistic view of their congregations and don't want to overwhelm them with the knowledge that is they now know that they have acquired. Do I like that? No, I think every priest or minister should get up from the pulpit and be as honest as Greta is. That is my opinion. But they don't do it. And at some point, maybe they will. Maybe they will.
I remember getting an email many years ago, from a clergy person who wrote that he was an economic coward, that he couldn't be honest with his community because he would lose his job. I had lunch with someone who is not in the ministry but is in academics, who wrote on the board of a class in critical thinking and ethics, "We are all African," and had evangelical Christians and Aboriginal people, students, align and go to the university authorities and have that stifled in that critical thinking course because it undermined belief systems. It's very difficult to challenge belief systems and to do so in ways that give permission to people to speak about it, because it's painful. And so to speak about it and be able to accommodate the reality of that pain is extremely hard. But that's the task at hand. I think that it's, you know, paternalistic to assume that you can't cope. But the reality is that when you start taking away a worldview, any worldview, there's pain involved with that and loss, and we have to be prepared to deal with that. And I think that denominations that are hemorrhaging don't want to deal with that because they feel that they'll lose more members.
Good. Just going to wrap up. I want to thank Catherine for being here today and explaining about your organization. So thank you very much. And I want to thank... And I also want to thank Greta for your continued honesty and courage. Thank you, Greta.